Do you have a card?
I know. Good morning, everyone. We want to get this session started. And the name of this session is Words Matter, Language and the World War II Japanese-American Experience. And I just want to tell you that if you have cell phones, if you could please turn them off, because we are taping this session. And our moderator for this session is George Takei. And I just want to remind all the speakers must speak into the microphone since we're audio recording this session. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much and welcome. Good morning, everyone. As was stated, this session is called Words Matter, Language and World War II Japanese-American Experience. Words are simply tools of communications, but they take on many different colorings. Words can be powerful. Words can be deceptive. Words can change with time. Words can inspire and move a people, such as the words from President John Kennedy, who said on his inaugural speech, "Ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country." And that moved thousands of young idealists to commit 2 years of their lives to humanitarian work in third world countries. Words can also do the very opposite. They can divide, generate hate to the point where it becomes genocide, such as the words from Adolf Hitler. Words can also dissemble. Words can be duplicitous. The words from President Richard Nixon, "I am not a crook." And words can change over time and the context in which we get it. As former mayor of Denver and former secretary of transportation said this morning in quoting President Franklin D. Roosevelt, "There is nothing to fear but fear itself." He said that at the beginning of the Depression. If he had only remembered that in 1942, words change. And there are words that cause pain that one can't forget. I was an 8-year-old boy back home in Los Angeles after the internment, and I had a third grade teacher who constantly referred to me as that Jap boy. It stung. It stung and has stayed with me still over 60 years. Words that have the power to be unforgettable and hurtful. And so with this session, we have three distinguished speakers who will present their perspective on words matter, how words can take on different colorations, how words can be powerful, how words can be inspiring, and how words can change. And to begin, we will call first on Dr. James Hirabayashi. During World War II, James Hirabayashi was detained in Pinedale Assembly Center before being transferred to the Tule Lake concentration camp in Northern California. After World War II, he earned his BA and MA in anthropology from the University of Washington and his PhD from Harvard University. Dr. Hirabayashi is Professor Emeritus of Anthropology and Ethnic Studies at San Francisco State University, where he was Dean of the nation's first School of Ethnic Studies. He also held research and teaching positions at the University of Tokyo, University of Alberta, Canada, and Amadou Bello University, I hope I pronounced that correctly, in Nigeria. So he's had a global educational experience. But he's also someone that I should consider competition because he is also an actor. He has acted with the Asian American Theater Company. He has appeared in a variety of Asian American plays produced in San Francisco. Currently, he is a senior program advisor at the Japanese American National Museum in Los Angeles. Our second speaker will be Dr. Warren Tsuneishi. Dr. Tsuneishi was born on the 4th of July, 1921. So what does that make you today?
87.
87 years old. So happy birthday and congratulations. Very appropriate to have him with us speaking today. He was born in Duarte, California, the third of six sons and three daughters of Satoru and Sho Murakami Tsuneishi, immigrants from Kochi Prefecture. He attended with his brothers and sisters a Saturday language school organized by Japanese families, mostly farmers, in the Monrovia, Arcadia, Duarte area, east of Los Angeles. He was not a very diligent student in the ethnic school and resisted the pro-Japanese message in the curriculum. He was in his third year at the University of California, Berkeley, when Japan attacked Pearl Harbor. Where are we here? Dr. Tsuneishi received his MA in 1948 from the Department of Chinese and Japanese, and his MSLS, and I asked him what that meant. He tells me that it means Master of Science in Library Science, MSLS in 1950, from the Graduate Library School, both at Columbia University, and his PhD in 1960 in Political Science from Yale University. He served as curator of the East Asian Collection and then as chief of the Asian Division of the Library of Congress until his retirement in 1993. He was professionally active in the Association of Asian Studies, the Association of Research Libraries, the American Library Association, where he joined with colleagues in organizing a series of Japan-U.S. conference on libraries. He served as president from 1983 to 1992. In addition to numerous articles and professional journals, his writings include Japanese Political Style, published by Harper and Row in 1966, joint editorship of the Proceedings of the First 1972, Second 1974, Fourth 1990, and the Fifth 1992 Conference on Library and Information Sciences in Higher Education. He is a member of the Japanese American Citizens League and the Japanese American Veterans Association. He has served the latter as vice president since 1993. And our third speaker is Mr. David Hayes. And the only non-Japanese here has been the most Japanese in deferring to his seniors here.
As I should.
Mr. Hayes was brought up in an army family in the U.S. military facilities in Germany and Japan during the 1950s and 1960s. Their stay in Yokosuka, Japan in 1956 had long-lasting effects on the family. He conducted research in civil rights and desegregation at Colorado University between the years 1938 and 1966. David Hayes received his BA from the University of Idaho in 1974 and became a commissioned lieutenant in the U.S. Army and served in the East German border from 1975 to 1978. He attended graduate school at the University of Colorado, receiving an MA in U.S. history in 1981. Since then, he has worked as an archivist in the libraries at the University of Colorado Boulder. He has created traveling exhibits on the history of racial and ethnic stereotypes in America. For the past 7 years, he has directed the U.S. Navy Japanese Oriental Language School Archives Project. And so we will begin with Dr. Hirabayashi.
Thank you. Actually, well, he mentioned about my acting. I was in ethnic studies just after the strike at San Francisco State. Incidentally, I was only the second Asian American on the staff at San Francisco State. S.I. Hayakawa was the first one. And he became the president and I was a striker. And we debated each other in the community, but never made it personal, so that after the strike, he appointed me the Dean of Ethnic Studies, and I switched out of anthropology and ethnic studies. At that time, the Asian American Theater Company started, and I didn't know anything about acting, but I said, I sure as hell can act better Issei than these damn sanseis around. That's how I got involved. Now, I wasn't initially scheduled to be on this panel, so that I'm going to leave all the nitty-gritty and the facts and all these kinds of things up to my eminent colleagues. And I'm just going to talk to you about an incident relating around the work that I was doing at the museum and at ethnic studies, relating to words matter. Now, it was in 1976 that there's an article in the San Francisco Examiner, and this is maybe about 3 years into the ethnic studies period for me. There's an article that said, there's a semantic debate on war camps. And it was the California State Historical Resource Commission. And they were putting up two national parks at two of the sites in the state of California, one at Manzanar and one at Tule Lake. And as you mentioned, I was in the one at Tule Lake. Now, the chairman of that commission was an anthropologist who taught at the University of California. I knew about him. And as the chairman of that commission, he voted no to using the term concentration camp on the plaques. And so I wrote and exchanged a mail with him on the issue. And he says, well, he doesn't believe in editorializing on the plaques. So I argued with him and said, hey, concentration camps, by Webster's definition, is a place where political prisoners are kept under armed guard. As far as I could see from my experience, that's what they were. And he says, well, he didn't believe in euphemisms. And I rebutted and said, well, seems to me that relocation centers and evacuation are euphemisms used by the government. And Webster says euphemisms, well, they're terms, inoffensive terms that are substituted for offensive ones. And, well, I says, there are a lot of government officials that used concentration camps, like President Roosevelt, President Truman, there's Attorney General Francis Biddle, Ickes, the Interior Chair, and also Justices Owen Roberts, Tom Clark, and Hugo Black, all used term concentration camps and referring to what happened to the Japanese Americans. Now, when the museum decided to put up an exhibit on the experience, we had a debate within the staff, and we all agreed to use America's concentration camps as a subtitle for the exhibit. Well, I got hate mail from people. You know, when you go to museums, you have to put in your comments and that kind of stuff. Well, there are hate stuff coming in there. And then we traveled to the exhibit because the director of the Ellis Island Museum saw the exhibit and he thought it would be good to have it at that museum in Ellis Island. And so we prepared the exhibit and sent it over, and then the controversy started. And the curator over there said that they wouldn't take the exhibit unless we changed the title. And I argued that, you know, we shouldn't change the title, that's what they are, and so on and so forth. And they had meetings over there. And some people were arguing that they're, you know, it's nothing like the Jewish experience in Europe, the Holocaust and everything like that. And, you know, it's the Japanese American camps are nothing like that. And so they had meetings. And I think at one of the meetings, eventually, there was Senator Inouye standing up there. And it's kind of hard to argue against him when he's there. You know, he's doesn't have his arm and stuff because of the war effort. And if he's there, it's, you know. So I think finally we did manage to keep the subtitle. Now, for those that argue that it's not like the Jewish experience, I say, well, that's true. But to me, to call the Jewish experience the concentration camps, I think it's almost like a euphemism because there are death camps. And and oddly enough, some of the researchers did studies on the Jewish experience, and they found that the Jewish, the Germans had used assembly center and relocation camps as terms, as their euphemistic terms. But I point out that, they were really death camps, and that there is a big difference because Nazi Germany at that time was working under the rules of the Third Reich. And what about us? We were working under the rules of the Constitution. So there's a big difference. Now, there is an education role for the Japanese American National Museum, and, you know, I'm very happy to see that they have organized a conference like this. We need to know of the nation's experiences, and when they stray away from fundamental principles of the Constitution. And like the speaker said today, this morning, erosion of rights for any citizen is an erosion of rights for all citizens. So anyway, with these comments, I'll turn the nitty-gritty of the meeting over to my colleagues.
Well, thank you, Dr. Hirabayashi. Words matter and how they're used, euphemisms. Our next speaker, Dr. Tsuneishi, will speak on language and how language can also be a tool. In fact, sometimes a tool much more effective than bullets or bombs. Dr. Tsuneishi.
Thank you, George. Thank you, George. Professor Hirabayashi, Mr. Denny, ladies and gentlemen, fellow Americans. I want you to remember that I call you fellow Americans because words do matter. Confucius said, the beginning of wisdom is to call things by the correct names. And as far as I'm concerned, the correct name for me is American. No, I wasn't going to come to this convention. I was a long way from home, and I have some problems. But when my granddaughter, Monica, learned that I was going to be on a panel with George Takei, she's a Trekkie, you must understand that. And she said, you're not going when George Takei... So I came. I listened to my wife and my children, unlike many Japanese men. I violated something. Again, I call myself an American as I'm a Japanese man. Well, you can't be consistent all the time, right? I even got Mr. Takei to sign a book for my granddaughter called Photo Album, and he wrote the introduction to it. Thank you. I'm going to be trying to cover three disparate subjects in the 15 minutes allotted to me. First will be words, words matter, and the second will be language. I was a Japanese language specialist in the U.S. Army Military Intelligence Service during World War II. Third, I want to go, this is a war in the Pacific. I want to say something that's quite peculiar to that war in the Pacific, and it is mass suicide. Let me begin then with words. As Mr. Takei indicated, I was born on the 4th of July, and I, on occasions like this, I tried to sing that song, but my wife has prohibited me from singing it because I have a lousy singing voice. But George volunteered to sing it for me. I'm a Yankee Doodle Dandy.
Later.
Later.
This is your time.
Well, you have to remember that since I'm born on the 4th of July, real life nephew of my Uncle Sam, I grew up in California with this self-image as a Yankee Doodle Dandy. Now, every time I looked in the mirror, I could see that I wasn't a Yankee. Nevertheless, I molded myself into the stereotype of a Yankee, more American than Americans. That's why I say I'm an American. Okay. I grew up pledging allegiance to the flag of the United States of America in Doherty Grammar School, the words end with liberty and justice for all. Liberty and justice for all. In the Declaration of Independence, you find words like equality. We hold these truths to be self-evident that all men are created equal. This from a man who held slaves. How do you understand that? Then you hear fine words like duty. The last words of the Declaration of Independence are to this end, that is to the end of liberty and freedom. We solemnly pledge our lives, our fortunes, and our sacred honor. I grew up as a Boy Scout. I pledged, you know, that you say that you're going to be Well, they have taken the West Point motto, honor, duty, and country, and added God to it. But that's essentially what, that's what I grew up with. Words like that, that have meaning to me. These, of course, these words, of course, come from, except for God, come from the age of enlightenment, age of reason. That's the very foundation of the American Republic. The values that undergird our democracy are words of this type. We couldn't be Americans without them. But how was it that following Pearl Harbor, all of a sudden, I was no longer an American, I was a Jap. The newspapers were full. The Los Angeles Examiner, the McClatchy Press, even the Los Angeles Times was full of a hateful word. I couldn't find myself accepting that. There is a very interesting book by John Dower called, I have immaculate, so I can't be clearly, but it's War Without Mercy, Race and Power in the Pacific War. Pacific War, how can a war be Pacific? But he's talking about war in the Pacific Theater War. And he spends quite a bit of time discussing how it is that this situation came about, that all of a sudden 110,000 Americans became Japs, just like the enemy. All right? And if you're interested in learning about the details, the images, the cartoons, the caricatures, the words, the hateful words, the racist words that appeared in the press were broadcast not only by the news, but were repeated by politicians, including the mayor of Los Angeles, including Earl Warren, the attorney general of the state of California, later governor, and then later, of course, chief justice of the Supreme Court. And it was he who presided over Brown versus Board of Education. How do you understand that? Very liberal finding and very conservative in 1941 and 42. So words do matter. And I like to think that I can understand what happened. There's another book that I will call to your attention. This book was published in 1996. This book by George Lightcalf was published just last year. And it's called When I Am. When I agreed to, after some input from my granddaughter that I would come here, I wrote out something. It turned out to be 12 pages long. And I told George about this, and he said, oh, just play my ear, you know, talk off the top of your head. The problem is that age 87, your cognitive abilities start to slow down, and your memory goes, and all of that kind of thing. So it's very hard for me to talk off of the top of my head. But I'm trying to call this book to your attention. It's by George Lightcalf, and it's called, I have Macular Degeneration also, The Political Mind. Yes, yes, The Political Mind. Why you cannot understand 21st century politics with an 18th century brain. He's talking, of course, about the age of reason. And when he's talking about and the Enlightenment, and he's talking about the fact that most of what we call thinking and what we think is reasonable, rational thought, intellectual thought, most of what we call thinking is done by only 2% of your brain capacity. The rest of it is some unconscious. It's visceral. It goes on in other parts of the body. And he's saying that it is fairly easy when you are fearful, when you are hysterical because of a possible invasion of your home country, it is possible to use what you consider called thinking as a substitute for what is something else. Again, it is still thinking, but a very different kind of thinking, the visceral kind of thinking. You know, when you sometimes have to make a decision, you say, my gut tells me to do something. That's thinking with your gut, with your viscera. But it's a different kind of thinking than the thinking of the age of reason that resulted in words like equality, justice for all, and so forth. So words do matter. And they had a devastating effect on those of us of Yuppie's ancestry fallen Pearl Harbor. But I only have a few moments. Let me talk about my second topic, which is my service as a Japanese language specialist in the U.S. Army Military Intelligence Service. The school that I attended was at Camp Savage in Minnesota. It had begun in the 4th Army G2, G2's intelligence, 4th Army G2 under the same John L. DeWitt. He had two junior officers who had studied in Japan, in the American Embassy in Tokyo, studied the Japanese language, had become very acquainted, this is the 1930s, had become very much acquainted with what was going on in Japan, and who were very concerned that ultimately war would come between Japan and the United States. And if that happened, the U.S. Army should be prepared by a coterie of trained Japanese language specialists. These two junior officers sold this to John DeWitt, and he began a class, opened a class, in November 1, 1941, 5 weeks before Pearl Harbor. The Navy had started its own program as Mr. Day would tell you, earlier that year in September at Harvard and at University of California, Berkeley, eventually moved to Colorado. Because General DeWitt was hoisted by his own petard. He was the one who issued the order on evacuation. He was the one who issued the order on the exclusion area. Nobody of Japanese ancestry could remain in the coastal areas of California. There was his school at the Presidio of San Francisco with his Japanese language program. And so that school had to be moved too, and moved to Minnesota, where the governor, Harold Stassen, was comfortable with having us there. General DeWitt, of course, was one of the leaders of the anti-Jap movement. It's one of those curious things about how, on the one hand, he can wear the hat of a supporter of the Japanese language service training, and on the other hand, call us a bunch of Japs, you can't be trusted, you can't determine which are wrong, which are not. How can he think that way? Well, people do think in peculiar ways, and afraid of that, sure of that. He gave in his congressional testimony in early 1943, when asked by a congressman why he could not separate the loyal Japanese Americans from the disloyal, he said, "You can't do that. The Japs are Japs. You can't trust any of them." That was his point of view, and that he was the one who started this Japanese language program. Let me get to that program. I was, before I do, recruiting for the school. Following Pearl Harbor, all Japanese Americans were reclassified as 4C, that's enemy alien. Those of us who had been drafted before the war, like my older brother Hughes, was either discharged or were permitted to remain. My older brother Hughes was permitted. He went to Camp Savage, And then in 1943, when the War Department decided that they really needed some of us as Japanese language specialists in the Pacific Theater, and hundreds and thousands in the European Theater with the 100th or 42nd. So they changed their policy and opened the draft for those of us who would volunteer. I volunteered for the service because of these things that the documents that I still believed in, even though some of my historical citizen colleagues did not. I still held fast to those beliefs that one day American people might wake up and found that they had done something wrong and that they would correct it. I believe that. This is before redress. Some people might call me a banana for that. Yeah, I'm white on the inside and yellow on the outside. But I still consider myself an American, because the color of your skin should not determine what you are as a citizen of this country. That's why I find it hard to understand why Martin Luther King Jr., on his I Have a Dream speech, had to say, someday, I hope that I dream that my three children will be judged not by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character. Someday. Those ideals in the Declaration of Independence, equality and of law, why did it take over almost 200 years for, and it was still not enforced, still not in play among the American people, still are not today, I don't think. But Martin Luther King had to speak of these as a dream and not a reality. Words do matter. Let me get to the services of Dutch language specialists. We were classified by the Army according to our knowledge and ability in Japanese and English as interpreters, interrogators, or translators. I was classified as a translator. My minor was English. And as George Takei said earlier, I was an indifferent student in Japanese. I hated to study Japanese. Like a lot of immigrants, as children of immigrants to this family, every immigrant group to this country tries to continue its language ability and stuff, the special language schools. The Japanese were no different in that regard. But a lot of students who go to the Estandis hate this because they want to be thought of and treated as Americans. If you go to a Japanese language school, they'll be treated as Japanese. If you go to a Chinese language school, be treated as Chinese, and so forth. It's kind of universal. That's how I explain my indifference as a student of Japanese. But you know something? When I was in the field trying to use my Japanese, I regretted that I had not been a better student.
Well, if I can interrupt here, Dr. Tsuneishi's service in the Military Intelligence Service and those of many, many others with the Military Intelligence Service was a potent, powerful service to the conclusion of the Second World War. They translated documents, they interrogated prisoners, they broke enemy codes, and it is said that the work of the Military Intelligence Service shortened the war by 2 years and saved many countless millions of Allied lives. So we are very
grateful.
Also,
Japanese lives.
Japanese lives as well, yes. Yes, indeed. So thank you. We want to move on because we want to have enough time for a dialogue with the audience. So next, may I call on Mr. David Hayes. He is truly the keeper of the word as an archivist.
Distinguished panelists, ladies and gentlemen, we have heard the meaning and effect of the vocabulary used by the majority aimed at the minority Japanese and Japanese Americans while the United States was at war with the Empire of Japan. However, there is quite another formerly secret and almost unknown story of the Japanese American sensei at the U.S. Navy Japanese Language School at the University of Colorado. These sensei, through the teaching of Japanese, made a large contribution to both the war effort and the peace through their teaching of the Japanese language and the actions of their students. Scholars have been surprised to discover the influence these Navy and Marine language officers had in naval and marine intelligence, radio interception, code decryption, document translation, and prisoner of war interrogation during the war. But other scholars in East Asian studies have been equally astounded to discover the influence these former language officers wielded in the U.S., Japanese, and Asian studies between 1950 and 1990. Even less well known, but also amazing, is the influence that other former Japanese language officers had in the various U.S. intelligence agencies and in American diplomacy during the same period. Truly, it could be said that they dominated those fields in the understanding of Japan and the spreading of that understanding through the United States. In fact, if I may digress, I'm making a bibliography of the books written by graduates of the U.S. Navy Japanese Language School, and it is already, although I'm only halfway through the lists of names, it is already more than 100 pages long. Edward Seidensticker, Donald Keen, Ivan Morris, Roger Hackett, Saul Levine, the list is endless.
Frank Gibney, too, I think.
Yes, Frank Gibney, Richard White, anybody knowing the field of Japanology or knowing the names of Japan hands would be amazed at how many of them had been Navy or Marine language officers during World War II, trained at Boulder or Berkeley. Yes, well, I'm only echoing yours. A new scholarship is slowly developing that is beginning to reveal the importance of this small wartime Navy school and its 1,650 attendees. But if the graduates contributed so greatly to the American academic intelligence and diplomatic understanding of Japan and Asia, were not the most important contributors those who taught them and turned their minds and understanding to matters Japanese? Are not the real bridge builders of that intellectual arch across the Pacific the sensei of the U.S. Navy Japanese Language School? I believe an argument can be made for this contention. Actually established in Japan, the U.S. Navy, Army, and State Department Japanese language schools educated small numbers of Foreign Service, Military, and Naval Academy officers after the stunning triumph of the Japanese Empire over the Russian Empire in 1905. For 30 years, the Navy assigned individual Naval Academy graduates to a three-year course in Tokyo, for which their chief sensei, Naoe Naganume, it's Naganuma, created a set of instructional texts that immersed the students in Japanese culture and history while teaching the language. By 1940, the U.S.-Japanese diplomatic tensions both required the transfer of the school to the United States and suggested changes in student numbers and length of training. The Navy had to find a new school location while enlarging the school enrollment and shortening the program's length from 3 years to 14 months. These changes were necessary to provide the numbers of language officers necessary for wartime missions as soon as possible. American academics in Japanese language were not convinced that they could teach Japanese to students in 14 months. The Navy Japanese Language School organizer, Commander Albert E. Hindmarsh, knowing the difference between education and training, as anybody in the services would know, dismissed the use of academics to train naval students in Japanese, preferring to recruit bilingual Japanese-American professionals for the new Naganuma program. After an experiment at both Harvard University and the University of California, Berkeley, in 1940-41, showed that Berkeley would best follow the Navy model, the program recruited a number of Japanese-American sensei to teach the several dozen largely Japanese and China-raised American students. However, after the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor and the subsequent executive order 9066, the U.S. Navy Japanese Language School had to move east so that its sensei would not be interned, halting instruction. The University of Colorado proved the perfect location in one of the few Western states and universities that did not bar Japanese residents or attendance. Governor Robert Carr had welcomed the Japanese to Colorado. University President Robert Stearns was looking for Navy schools to offset both the draft and the enlistment drain from university enrollment. So the Navy school, students, and Sensei moved to the University of Colorado in June of 1942. The director of the school was Florence Walm, a Berkeley faculty member, but the ranking instructors, Sensei, were Susumu Nakamura and Henry Tatsumi, a Japanese language professor from the University of Washington. By October 1942, it was obvious to the Navy and Commander Hindmarsh that the number of Japanese-American instructors had to increase to accommodate rising student enrollment. The Japanese-American sensei were encouraged to recruit bilingual Japanese-American professionals, doctors, lawyers, teachers, of their acquaintance from the transit and internment camps. Hindmarsh had general advertisements placed in camp newspapers. Language school instructor recruits and their families often faced the hostility of their fellow internees for their choice to serve the country that had interned them. The vast majority of sensei between 1942 and 1946 would be Japanese American, 164 of the total 177 recruited to teach at the school. But once in Boulder, at the University of Colorado, a remarkable synergy took place. One can easily view the transformation from the stories that have been submitted to 7-8 years now of our U.S. Navy Japanese Oriental Language School Archival Project's newsletter, The Interpreter. The Japanese American sensei were able to use the Naganuma texts along with other of their own devising, like Ensho Ashikaga's Kaigun Tokohon, the Sosho text, and a number of Japanese language dictionaries to install a novel and unexpected admiration of Japan, its people and its culture, in young American naval students immediately following Pearl Harbor. While the wartime American culture trumpeted anti-Japanese rhetoric and flashed racist stereotypes, these young students, themselves former faculty members, graduate students, and language academics, found themselves beguiled by their sensei and the texts in the most intellectually rigorous of Navy training programs. Not only did the students grow to admire the Japanese culture and society they viewed through kanji and folk tales, but they also held their sensei in very high esteem. Far from feeling that they were being taught by an enemy, they trusted and venerated their sensei. It was an appreciation that grew to be mutual as the sensei began to respect the dogged determination and skill of their students. The sensei also invited their students to parties and dinners at their home, where their children would sing songs to the students, and the sensei family would share their small food ration of Japanese cuisine with them. In this way, students were able to view the application of what they were learning into an actual traditional Japanese family life and social behavior. Students and sensei exchanged presents, art, and a lifelong high regard. One sensei, speaking for many, told his children that some of the best times of his life were spent teaching Japanese to young U.S. naval students in Boulder, Colorado. The Japanese-American sensei of the U.S. Navy Japanese Language School used Japanese words, kanji, to immerse more than 1,200 Caucasian men and women in the language and culture of Japan. The graduates that went into the Navy and Marines were intercepted, decrypted, and translated, and interpreted Japanese radio traffic, translated captured Japanese documents, interrogated Japanese POWs, negotiated the surrender of bypassed Japanese units, arranged the repatriation of prisoners, and assisted in the administration during the occupation of Japan, although not as often as the Army guys did, because MacArthur didn't like Navy people. Language officers created clinics for wounded language prisoners in the heat of battle on Okinawa. Language officers created a school for Japanese children in Japanese, taught by Japanese teachers on Tinian, on the very island that B-29s were taking off to bomb Japan. Language officers translated leaflets into Japanese and dropped leaflets and used PA systems to encourage the surrender and dissuade Japanese soldiers and civilians from committing suicide. In one case, language officers were creating pamphlets at the headquarters, the forward headquarters of SINCPAC on Guam, with the 8th Air Force, or not the 8th Air Force, but the Air Force, the Army Air Corps in the Pacific. They dropped these leaflets in Japanese, the Japanese language leaflets, on Japanese cities, telling them to evacuate because their city would be bombed. In one case, one of the language officers was hunted down during the occupation by the mayor of a town that had taken the advice and evacuated before their town was destroyed. This is something that doesn't show up in Dower. One language officer was decorated for saving an entire captured Japanese unit from starvation. The behavior of Navy and Marine Japanese language officers toward Japanese prisoners and civilians has been described as sympathetic, sensitive, and through their knowledge of the culture and the society, extremely effective. Former Japanese POWs kept up long friendships or spent lifetimes seeking out their former captors in order to offer thanks. Not only did the sensei generate considerable effects during the Pacific War, the occupation and various national post-war occupations, the language school and its sensei had an enormous and measurable personal effect on their students and their families. While it could be expected that some were around 15% of the attendees of the school who had been born and raised in Japan or China would continue their interest in Asia, the vast majority of the attendees and graduates had their first immersion in the Japanese culture and language from the sensei of the U.S. Navy Japanese Language School. Of this majority, more than two-thirds of those who have contacted our project told us that the school and its sensei changed their lives. This claim is proven not only by the great numbers of graduates who later chose career in Asian studies, Far Eastern intelligence, and U.S. diplomacy in Asia, but also by their subsequent missionary work, U.S.-Japanese reconciliation activities, as well as by lifelong cross-racial friendships and interracial marriages with Japanese and Japanese Americans, and those of subsequent generations in their family who also married into Asian families. To a great degree, these unknown Japanese American sensei may have been unintentional traffic signs who, through their teachings, directed sharp turns to the east in the lives of many of their language, their Navy language students. One thing, going back to a comment by the previous speaker, I once asked my father, a colonel in the Army, who recently passed away. He had been a World War II veteran. I asked him during the Vietnam War to offer me some arguments about Vietnam. Words. He asked, pro or con? And then in the discussion, he gave me the arguments against such wars. And then and finally he looked at me and he said, on the other hand, one man's slavery is every man's slavery. One man's freedom is every man's freedom. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Hayes, for underscoring the fact that it's not only words that matter, but language, and not only in terms of weapons of battle, but as bridges to understanding and reconciliation. So, ladies and gentlemen, we have heard from three different speakers with various observations on how words matter, how words can be powerful, and how language can be significant, particularly for Japanese Americans at a time when the Japanese American community was trying to distance themselves from everything Japanese and trying to assert our Americanism. But now we get another idea of what it means to be an American. It means to be a person of the world. It means being proud of the heritages that we have. And I think language is an important part of that. Americans are famously monolingual. And in this global society now, the knowledge of languages to understanding other cultures, other people, become vitally important. And so now we open the fun part of this session, the dialogue, the conversation, and questions that you may have of our panelists here. So if you have thoughts that you'd like to share, if you can raise your hand, and we will begin the discussion. Yes.
Oh, That's right. I was not on the committee. I was just complaining about what the committee was. The question was, what happened to the issues of concentration camp with the commission? And as I said, I was not on the commission. There was an anthropologist there, and as an anthropologist myself, I knew who he was. And I complained to him because he had voted no, we should not use concentration camps on the plaques. And he had voted against it. But the director of the parks, an African American, ultimately decided to use the term so that concentration camps are used on the on the plaques at both Tule Lake and at Manzanar.
The question was on the book that Mr. Hayes is writing. You completed your book?
Actually, I'm writing. Let's see. I'm writing an article. It was an overlong article, so getting it published was difficult. On civil rights at the University of Colorado, and one half of it is being published this year or next year, depending on how long it takes. Well, I can probably make it available. It's going to be published, though, so it'll be in a larger book. We'll see if we can't get it down there. It's largely on the first civil rights effort at the University of Colorado, which started in 1938 and included attempts to ameliorate civil rights problems at both in Boulder and on campus. And included the Japanese Americans there, although there were only 20 at the time.
Yes, the hand over there. Oh, Min.
Well, one of the
question for the benefit of those that could not hear: what happened to the senseis that were brought here to Colorado, University of Colorado, from? Berkeley.
Well, many of them, we can only track them by, since the records of the school were not kept by the Navy. There is one report, but the academic records, which should have been voluminous, are no longer extant that we can find. But we have been able to track when they were hired in the Regents' minutes and when and what salaries they got and when they stopped working there. Now, a good number of them went to Stillwater in 1945 because the largest program, language program, was moved to Stillwater, the Japanese program. Because the university enrollment was going to go from 4,000 to 8,000 with the end of the European War. So they had no room, housing, classroom, or whatever, and they had to move the largest Navy program. That was a move that was not particularly met with a great deal of enthusiasm, and the Japanese language sensei were probably correct in being in having some fears about that, because unlike Boulder, where they lived all around town as they could find housing, down in Stillwater they were all placed in one area, I think in Quonset huts too. So So they went there. Now, many of these, some of these sensei were faculty members at various universities and went back. Henry Tatsumi went back to the University of Washington. Professor Ike went back to, I think he went to UCLA and then, or to Berkeley. A number of the people who taught Chinese went back to universities on the West Coast. So, but the majority of them probably went back to their hometowns because they weren't professional academics. They went back to the Bay Area and to the Los Angeles area to resume their lives. But I should say something here. In 1945, right at the end of the war, the Boulder city attorney went to a city council meeting, Boulder City Council meeting, and he said, since the FBI and the U.S. Army are lifting all of the restrictions on Japanese, wouldn't it be a good thing for us in Boulder to do the same thing? They tabled the request. And I'm not really sure that they've ever changed it. So there may those regulations might still be on file in Boulder City. It's an interesting thing. But it's really hard to get information on the sensei because so many of them passed away before we started this project. And not only that, the sensei kept very quiet about everything that happened to them. First of all, because it was a high security endeavor and was not open for people to talk about until the 80s. Secondly, because I think they really didn't know how to describe what they were doing to other people and didn't pass it on. My father is not Japanese American, and throughout his life he never talked about the war. So I can imagine that probably is partially the problem among the wartime generation as well. So we don't have a lot of information on what happened to many of the sensei who went back. Sorry, I can't answer your question better.
The gentleman in the second row that I...
I yes. have a comment oh. here.
Well, thank you for your very eloquent observation. Dr. Hirabashi had a comment on the previous...
Yeah, I just wanted to tack on something that David Hayes said. And I know that you people are learning a lot from attending this conference, and so am I. I didn't know that when I went to the University of Washington right after the war ended, 1945. And eventually, about junior year, I took Japanese language to study for the Far Eastern specialty in anthropology. And I find out today, sitting here, that my professor, Henry Tatsumi, this is the very same professor who is a sensei. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Well, thank you very much for shedding that light, Mr. Hayes. And yes, I must say this is a fantastic learning experience for all of us here. We're learning so much, and particularly about the language school. And you know, we're learning about it because they've been kept secret. It was hush-hush, and they weren't supposed to talk about it, even the individuals that were involved in the project, because of the military necessity of that period. Did I see a hand? Yes. The questioner asks, or says she's working on the preservation of which camp was it? Minidoka. And they're involved with interpretive centers. And they're publishing leaflets and other information on the internment camp. And she asks, what is the language that we should be using? Should we use concentration camp or internment camp? Should we use forced evacuation? Should we use the more direct term, or should we use the softer term? Yes, Mr. Hayes.
Well, speaking as an archivist involved in preserving legacies of things, often we get into the preservation of materials from the point of view of, I won't call it ignorance, but an insufficiency of knowledge. My insufficiency of knowledge about the language school couldn't have been bigger. So what I would recommend from your point of view is to get to do what we did with the Language School Archival Project, which is to develop an address list of and contact list of all of the people you can find who were in that camp. Because inevitably, the interpretation should be theirs. This is their camp. It's not the viewer's camp. It is their camp. You're right. And they should be included as part of the legacy. All of those people who were part of that experience, that historical experience belongs to them. And the only way you find out what kind of terminology you should use is by contacting them and we have a newsletter that we send out twice, or we used to send out twice a month for about 5 or 6 years. And I would recommend developing a net of contacts of the people who were involved in that historical experience. Because those are the people who are going to disagree. Now, the people who didn't live through that experience, their disagreements are going to be there too, but theirs are not going to be as important as the disagreements of the people who lived there and lived around there. So that would be from an archival point of view, that would be the way that I would combat that situation. Sure. Uh-huh. We try to put in all of the conflicts in ours. But go ahead.
I would say, you know, it should be put in context. All those conflicting viewpoints is what it is today. However, the people that were interned have this the people that went through that internment experience and the people that lived outside the barbed wire fence. So it should be put in that large context, and certainly in the context of today's time. Yes, way in the back. Mr. Ellington.
People
I might add, Mr. John Ellington is the owner of the land where the Jerome camp in Arkansas was built. He bought the land much after the internment, but he is the current owner of that land. Welcome to Denver, Colorado, Mr. Ellington from Arkansas. Yes, the fire. The lady in the second row.
I'm a retired educator, and on occasions like that, I need an interpreter. And quite frankly, I kind of wonder, I would say interpreters is better in the town, and I wonder if you interpreted that to me. Was there ever any instances of inaccurate translation during interrogation or whatever? And what were the measures that the military took to make sure that it was accurate?
A question with the Military Intelligence Service. How accurate was the translation, and what precautions did the military take to make sure that the translations were accurate? Dr. Tanashi?
We're talking about two different things now. Interpreting, I understand, is interpreting voices from one language to another. Spoken speech. Translation is translation of documents. I was a translator. There was no review of my translation work. It was assumed that the translator had done the job correctly. What else could you do about it? There was a very famous document captured in the war in the Pacific. It turned out to be the complete plans for the use of the remaining Imperial Japanese fleet. This is in 1944. And the translation was done by Army specialists at the in Brisbane, Australia. And then it was sent to JIPPOA, Joint Intelligence Center, Pacific Ocean Areas in Honolulu, to be reviewed by Navy officers, Navy Japanese officers. And they had some questions about the accuracy of the translations. But aside from things of that type, I don't recall that there was any review of what was done. Now, when you get to interpreting speech, that's an entirely different thing. All kinds of errors occur, can and do occur, but I don't know how you make corrections on that, except complain about it, but about the poor quality. Interpreting is a very difficult science, as you may know, and especially simultaneous interpreting, where you are interpreting what somebody is talking about, not reading from a speech which the interpreter may have in front of him or her, and but in simultaneously interpreting what one person is saying so that it can be understood by the second person and so forth. I don't know that there are any checks on that business of ensuring accuracy, except for reliance on your own competence, or professional competence of the interpreter.
Well, we have a lively discussion going, and I hate to stop it, but it's with regret that I do that, because our watches keep ticking on. I must say, though, that this was a very enlightening discussion. I know that I learned a great deal. So let's thank our panelists, Dr. Tanashi, Dr. Hirabayashi, and Mr. Hayes. Thank you very much.